Hello and welcome. It's been a week of relentless escalation in the Middle East, with Israeli airstrikes across Lebanon, Gaza and Yemen against Iranian-backed militants. Hundreds of civilians killed in the past 7 days, and in the south of Lebanon, quote, limited ground offensive began. Iran retaliated, almost 200 ballistic missiles launched across Israel, leading to much speculation over Israel's retaliation.
We're in discussion of that. I think that would be a little... Anyway.
It's been a week that's seen Mr. Teflon, Mott Rutter, take over the helm at NATO, and it's a nickname he's going to need as he takes on the job in the midst of a spiralling international crisis. He's also been called the Trump Whisperer. Handy, potentially, depending on who gets the keys to the White House. Rutter's first trip was Kyiv. It's inevitable, he says, that Ukraine will become a NATO member.
I think the day will come that Ukraine is a full member of NATO. And let me add to that, if somebody might think otherwise, that Russia on this issue has no vote and no veto.
And it's been Veep Week in the US, the running mates head-to-head in a debate of 90 minutes. No, they're eating the dog's viral moment. It was a surprisingly cordial affair with tough questions for both. Tim Walz saying he misspoke when suggesting he was in Hong Kong at the time of the Tiananmen Square massacre. J.D. Vance said he once compared Trump to Hitler, but only because of the mainstream media. As P.G. Wodehouse in Much Obliged Jeeves once wrote, the great thing in life, if we wish to be happy and prosperous, is to miss as many political debates as possible. So we ask, who won? Was it worth it? Does it matter?
He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
It's a damning non-answer.
I'm Gavin Lee. Welcome to The World This Week. Joining me from the International Press Corps tonight, Vivian Walt, correspondent for Time Magazine and Fortune. Fortune is on our side tonight, Vivian.
Thank you.
Must mention to you, first of all, you've been looking this week, Viv, at the effect of fighting in the Middle East on oil prices.
Yes, and actually I wrote a little piece which ran before the oil price spike, but it was very predictable that something was going to happen with oil. Look, this isn't the Middle East crisis as it was in 1973, which, you know, the world really sent the world economy into a total tailspin. It's not going to be like that again for one big reason, that the US is the world's biggest oil producer now, not the Middle East. But the US still needs to import a lot of oil, and that is the problem. And so you have these ripple effects. And the ripple effects happen very, very quickly. They can happen within a few days. Within a few days of the world market oil prices going to 77, 80, low 80s, maybe next week, a barrel, you will have American drivers paying much more at the pump for gas. And we're a month away from the US elections. So all in all, it's a very nerve-wracking prospect.
And even to that small degree of fluctuation, it just shows how the ripple effect quickly spreads to the everyday elsewhere and around the world.
Absolutely. Oil is traded globally and the effects are felt very, very quickly.
Catherine Norris-Trent is also with us. Catherine, just back from Ukraine, looking at the state of the conflict. One point probably worth saying, in a week where international attention has been on the Middle East, it's easily missed that there have been significant moments in Ukraine too.
Yeah, that's right. After fierce fighting for about 2 years around the southeastern town of Vuhledar, that finally fell into Russian hands as the Ukrainians withdrew in a very chaotic style. And that really pinpoints the difficulties they've been having there on that eastern front as the Russians edge forwards. I can see in the background you're playing the clip of when I took a trip into the Kursk region.
This is used in Kursk, yes.
Yeah, in Russia, embedded with the Ukrainian forces. They've taken part of Russian territory there. So we've got a very brief visit, but the Ukrainians hoping that they can use that as leverage, basically, to try and force Russia to end the war. That's what they call their victory plan. I mean, who knows how that's going to go?
We're going to get onto that. Both in Kursk, not many reporters have seen what it's like in that territory taken by Ukraine for now, and also in Pokrovsk as well in the east. Suzanne Kiampo, delighted to have you here as well. So CEO of Helmets to Heels, host of News with Suze on YouTube. Suzanne, you've been following the Middle East very closely. You've lived, you've worked in Lebanon. Your father is Iranian as well. How have you felt about this week?
So I just flew in from Dubai, and the day before I flew in, there was a video that went viral from a passenger who was flying into Dubai, and they saw the images of the missile attacks coming from the Islamic Republic of Iran. So the region is really caught between Israel and the Islamic Republic, and everything is kind of hanging in the balance. We don't really know what's going to happen. Sources that I've been speaking to who are familiar with Bibi Netanyahu thinking, have told me that everything is on the table, and there have been questions as to whether or not he will go not only as far as striking inside Iran, particularly nuclear sites, but also a potential hit on Iranian leadership. So it is definitely a testy region. I was actually based in Lebanon, in Beirut, 10 years ago, and so all of these parts of Beirut that are being hit, many of my former colleagues and friends are leaving. They've been displaced. And so it's chaos, yeah, to say the least.
We're going to get onto that. And you say everything is on the table for Netanyahu's government, perhaps apart from a ceasefire right now. That's one thing that's certainly not amongst the rhetoric. Great to have you here. Gil Mihaly as well. Great privilege to have you. Editor-in-chief of Kozor magazine. Gil, tell us about your week, what you've been working on, and what's struck you the most.
I've been working on an article about Israel a year after October 7th, to give you the bottom line. A house divided that tries to stand and doing fairly good job. So this is what I was working on, of course, looking around at what was happening and the
incursion. House being the political house of the government or the wider house of Israel?
Meaning that, like Lincoln. I mean, the Israeli society is at the same time divided like it rarely been since 49, and at the same time united in its war, even more in the north than in the south, because the Gaza campaign became controversial. The campaign against Hezbollah and Iran, much less. There's a quite large consensus in Israel that this is the occasion that they didn't choose, but they need to take advantage of it, because little by little, 45 years with a lot of patience, Iran caught Israel like Gulliver in a kind of a web.
It's interesting, and we're going to get onto it in a moment. Sure. Certainly when you talk about popularity and the one house, certainly the popularity of Benjamin Netanyahu amongst many Israelis has increased, and his government is expanding. Well, let's begin. This week, the early hours of Tuesday morning, the Israeli Defense Forces confirmed with a statement on Telegram that its soldiers had entered Lebanese territory, the beginning of what the IDF calls a, quote, limited, localized ground operation against Hezbollah targets, and with the aim of pushing militants back from the south to allow evacuate Israelis to return and missile attacks on its villages and towns, says the IDF. By Wednesday, first casualties announced, 8 Israeli soldiers confirmed dead. The move went ahead after days of Israeli air bombardment, including in Beirut, wiping out much of the Hezbollah chain of command, but also killing hundreds of civilians and 1 million people, according to the Lebanese Prime Minister, displaced. By Tuesday afternoon, Israel confirmed it was also striking new targets in Yemen against Iranian Houthi militants. Iran threatened retaliation. It came. Tuesday night, more than 180 ballistic missiles fired at Israeli towns, cities and military installations. We hear the sirens sounding across the country. 7:30 in the evening, the entire population, 10 million, taking shelter. 15 minutes later, social media footage recording missiles flying over. Jerusalem, Tel Aviv targeted. Israel's military said most of the missiles were intercepted. One reported death of a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank. Now, months of calls from Western allies to de-escalate have come to nothing. The former Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, says, quote, "It is the greatest opportunity in 50 years to change the face of the Middle East. Vivian, let's begin with your take on the week and where you think this is heading.
I mean, I think one of the most disturbing things is that the whole concept of diplomacy has essentially collapsed. And one of the more interesting moments of this past week was the Lebanese foreign minister coming out and saying that Hassan Nasrallah, just before he was killed, had basically accepted the ceasefire deal and had let the Lebanese government know. Now, of course, he's not around to confirm that. We have to take the Lebanese government's word for it. But if that is the case, one is left wondering whether the timing was coincidental, whether the Israelis felt they had to move at that moment because they couldn't accept a ceasefire. They thought it was absolutely impossible for them to choose a diplomatic route. They don't trust it. And the U.S. seems powerless to actually persuade them to do so. I think this has been one of the most aggravating things of the past year. And there does, at this point, seem to be no big power, really, capable of acting as a kind of honest broker. The U.S. was never seen as that anyway. But there is no one else.
No big power, Catherine. Interesting that China is talking about its own diplomatic effort. You're back and forth to Israel, to the Middle East all the time. Interesting, if true what Vivian says, which is true, certainly what the Lebanese foreign minister has been saying, that there was a ceasefire on the table that Hassan Nasrallah was ready to sign. And we see in New York, well, two things. A speech given by Benjamin Netanyahu. Before that, his team taking a picture when he signed off the order to kill Nasrallah. Your take at the moment of where things stand right now?
Well, I think we've also got to put this in the context of we're coming up very closely to the year anniversary of October the 7th. And politically, Benjamin Netanyahu is in an extremely delicate position, has been for some time. But actually launching this new war on this new front has taken those questions somewhat out of the forefront for a moment, because, of course, there are all the hostages still remaining inside Israel. It's been sort of bigger and bigger street protests, real anger, strike growing there. And at the moment now, we're not talking about those hostages so much. We're not talking about the bombings of civilians in Gaza. We're looking north to this northern front. So, you know, this is another... I don't know how cynical one wants to be, but it's certainly changed the situation on the ground at the moment of this anniversary. And speaking to people inside Israel, very much echoing what Gil was saying and repeating some of the elements of that tweet by Naftali Bennett, the former Israeli prime minister, saying, this is our chance to reshape the reason. So some Israelis really that I've spoken to kind of saying, look, we've got to seize this opportunity. We won't get this again. So, you know, this kind of escalate to de-escalate, but to try and basically shape the region how they want to be. I mean, whether they can do so, I mean, it's a huge question.
But that's escalate to de-escalate, Gil. When you look at when you have a tactical victory, it's different to a strategic victory. What do you make of Naftali Bennett's comments? Do you feasibly see a possibility of changing the face of the Middle East? And in what way?
During the first decades of the existence of Israel, the main element that stopped peace in the region was the Soviet Union. We were in the Cold War situation, and the Soviet Union backed Syria, Egypt. Peace with Egypt was only possible because Egypt became a Western country with Sadat in the 70s. And then when the Soviet Union disintegrating, Iran started to play the same game. They tried to derail the peace with Egypt. They tried to derail the Oslo process. They succeeded. They finance Hezbollah. There is no real problem between Israel and Iran, but the Iranian regime decided in 79 that destroying Israel is one of its main objectives. Difficult to find a diplomatic solution to that. You can exchange messages, but what can Israel do that will satisfy Iran?
Well, there are
except
two issues.
This, except
you have an existential issue which you're talking about. You also
issue.
Have an issue. That
so what the idea is that since the head of the snake is Iran. It's Iranian. Without Iranian backing money and arms and training, Hezbollah will probably become kind of an Amal, a kind of a Shiite or PLO. Lebanese party with a glorious military past, with a small militia, but it won't be the Hezbollah of Nasrallah, okay? Hamas also will have a big problem without Iranian support. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the same. So if you get the Iranian out of the game, it's almost as important as the breaking of the Soviet Union and what happened in the decade afterwards, peace with Jordan, peace with peace process with the Palestinians, yeah. Relations with the Arabs, with the Gulf states, and people say that regime change and state building failed, which is true. It failed where there was never a state nor a nation. You can't rebuild Iraq. Because there's no Iraqi nation and there was never an Iraqi state. It's true for Libya. It's true for Afghanistan. It's not true for Japan, Germany, and Iran. Iran has a long history of a nation, yes. Nation and a state.
Okay. Suzanne, you've spent time in Lebanon. Gil's talking about other countries in the Gulf coming together. We had the Abraham Accords before October the 7th. You had a lot of normalizations, Morocco towards maybe Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Gil talking about actually knocking the head off a serpent and trying to eradicate Hezbollah, seen by many countries as a terrorist organization, from within the state. But that's easier to say than the reality of how it is operating as a state within a state.
So it's interesting because 2 years ago in 2022, it looked like we were on the verge of the new Middle East. So we were seeing the potential for normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. We also then ended up a year later having the China-hosted deal between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia.
And succeeded.
Yes, exactly. And now that seems like that's all just blown out of the water on the surface. But the sources that I've been speaking to, particularly Saudi sources, publicly, they say, we're not going to allow our airspace to be used for any strike on Iran. You know, we're not going to have normalization with Israel.
But that seemed counter, doesn't it, to what actually happened with some of the Israeli strikes over Yemen?
Exactly. So publicly, they have to say these things. And mainly that's because of the public sentiment towards not wanting to have normalization with Israel without a Palestinian state. So that's very crucial. But privately, it is in both Saudi Arabia and Israel's interest to have a deal. And the Iranians obviously know that. I mean, right now, the Islamic Republic of Iran is the weakest that it's ever been. And also internally, they don't have the support of the people like they used to, the population. I mean, the last time I was here on set was the Iranian elections in June, and they had to keep extending the polling hours because there weren't enough people to go and vote. And then suddenly we saw Pezeshkian, this reform candidate, winning, which is essentially he was allowed to win by the supreme leader. So these are indicators that the Iranian regime knows that they're in trouble. And quite frankly, from people that I've been speaking to inside Iran, if there were to be an all-out war, if Israel were to bomb Iran, Iran declares war, the average Ali is not going to vote, is not going to rather fight for this regime.
Do you consider Iran a paper tiger?
Yeah.
Yeah. The rhetoric being different to the reality of what it's potentially capable of. I mean, either way, I guess it's a very interesting point Suzanne makes, and we're in a very worrying state. Vivian, I also want to listen to something. Tell me, was this a mistake by Joe Biden? Was this a kind of, quote the cricket term, playing a googly? Did he deliberately know what he was doing? Let's have a listen to Joe Biden talking to reporters about discussions with Israel about what could come next.
We're in discussion with that. I think that would be a little... Anyway.
Okay, so we knew, Vivian, that they weren't... The Americans made clear, do not strike nuclear facilities. What was going on there?
Mistake, if I had to guess. Sort of classic Biden, wanting to kind of like share that he's he's still in power, right? I mean, he's hardly around anymore. And it's a moment in which he can sort of present himself as still the guy in the White House. Obviously, it seems obvious that they might strike oil facilities. It's happened before, right? And
it happened in Yemen a few days ago.
Right, it happened in Yemen a few days ago. And for that matter, Iran has struck Saudi oil facilities just a few years ago. So I think that's clear that that might happen.
What interests me, Catherine, as well, nobody, last week, the week before, we were kind of talking about a ceasefire. That talk has disappeared. We listened to the rhetoric tonight of escalate to de-escalate, as you mentioned. Where is the off-ramp right now?
This is what I think is one of the most worrying things, is that we don't see it. We don't see the Israelis want, or Benjamin Netanyahu in any case, wants an off-ramp. They're going full speed ahead. It seems very difficult. As Vivian said, the diplomacy is non-existent at this stage, as far as I know. I mean, hopefully things are going on behind closed doors and people are trying to get some kind of solution. But this is the worrying thing. We're trying to guess where it's going to go next, and retaliation against retaliation, and the rhetoric ramping up as well. I don't really see an off-ramp at the moment. Things certainly are changing very quickly at the moment in the Middle East, so hopefully they'll change quickly in a positive way as well.
Change quickly in a positive way. Gil, you talk about Naftali Bennett's comments of potential change in the Middle East, but interesting, the IDF spokesperson saying today, particularly when it came to localised, quote, ground offensive in the south of Lebanon, which has already reached north of Tyr, which is now going into the mainland of Lebanon, there is an area...
The evacuation orders,
now, which we know what often happens after that, which we've seen a pattern of, which is continued offensive. He was asked, the IDF spokesperson, this has happened before, localised becomes an all-out war. You talk about the benefits, but isn't the risk that you're just going to lose hearts and minds, as we heard so many other countries before, like Iraq?
You're absolutely right. And this is why, until October 6th, Netanyahu's strategy was containment. Netanyahu doesn't like wars because war is risky, and because Netanyahu doesn't have a lot of confidence in Mossad, in generals. They know they always exaggerate. They always say everything will be okay. And then, you know, like the guy that come to do the paint job, it takes twice as much as long and costs three times more. The army is just like that, just like a mason. So, and excuse me for all the masons that I've just... And so he knows that. The first election that he won was because Shimon Peres was involved in a war in Lebanon just a month before. And, you know, there were the civilian death, and then a month later the elections, and Shimon Peres lost because of this war. So he doesn't like that. And he did everything, paying the Hamas leadership, avoiding a large war, even manipulated his government in order to avoid large wars. Hezbollah was provocating, was sending. They sent a man to make a terrorist attack inside Israel. They tried to kill a general. They planted tents in an area which is north of the fence, but in Israeli sovereign territory, yeah, because of topography, yeah, problems. He didn't do anything. Why? Because he knew, you know, the price of the oil, the election in the United States. For Israel, it's never a good time to disturb everyone else's afternoon nap.
I see.
So, because Sinwar last year decided to turn the table, he said, okay.
He changed the game.
He turned the table. Our men are already in work. Yeah. Their businesses are already bankrupt.
Yeah. Gil,
well, we should go all the way.
We go all the way, very clear. And you talk about Sinwar still missing, the Hamas leader somewhere in Gaza, presumed to be in a tunnel somewhere. Well, it takes us on to outside of the Middle East, another big moment this week. Tuesday, the 1st of October, new broom sweeps clean at NATO. Out went Jens Stoltenberg, who'd served for a decade, exactly to the day. as Secretary General in. Well, it was Goeiemiddag. Welcome to Mark Rutte, the former Dutch Prime Minister, and a man with many nicknames, useful if true, in taking on a job in the midst of some major international crises. Dutch ex-colleagues call him Mr. Teflon for his political survival skills. EU officials saw him as Mr. No for his rejection of President Macron's EU reform plan, and a skill he can draw on in the US if things go a certain way in this election. He picked up the moniker the Trump Whisperer, as he's said to have calmed the ex-president and current candidate down at the 2018 summit. So, Rutte's first overseas trip Thursday, straight to Kyiv, meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky to the sound of intermittent air sirens in the capital, telling reporters Ukraine's path to membership of NATO was inevitable.
Targeting Russian fighter jets and missiles before they can be used against Ukraine's civilian infrastructure can help save lives. The only country here that has crossed a red line is not Ukraine, it is Russia. I think the day will come that Ukraine is a full member of NATO. And let me add to that, if somebody might think otherwise, that Russia on this issue has no vote and no veto.
We need sufficient quantity and quality of weapons, including long-range weapons that, in my opinion, our partners are already dragging out. And we talked today about Ukraine's need for air defense and additional cooperation with neighbors. We see how, in particular in the Middle East, it is possible to protect people's lives thanks to the unity of allies.
And we're told two elements they discussed was President Zelensky's so-called, unofficial so far, victory plan coming at a difficult time for Ukraine, just as it's bogged down in the east with Russian forces capturing the hilltop mining town of Vukledar after 2 years of Ukrainian resistance, as Catherine just said. Catherine, I'm going to ask about your time in a moment. First of all, just tell us about the seizure of this town. You mentioned it at the top. Why does Vukledar matter?
So it's been a place, it's kind of, if you look at the southern front and the eastern front in Ukraine, it's where they meet. It's in a corner from where Russian troops could potentially advance towards, well, the edge of the Ukrainian-controlled Donbass. And it's somewhere that Ukraine has managed to hold off the Russian advances of troops for 2 years. So you've got a lot of very exhausted men there in battalions who've been fighting to keep this front from advancing, and they finally withdrew because they were encircled by Russian troops. So it's important because it's the latest in a series of towns that has fallen, and we are seeing the gains now adding up. And when I was down not far from Vuhledar, actually, and on the last trip, it really struck me from the time I was last there, which was a year previously, this has long been a drone war. But the sheer number of drones, the FPV drones, exploding drones that the Russians have mass-produced has changed the game. That they were there before, and the Ukrainians are using them too. But what they say is that Russia sees a technique that's working, that's relatively cheap to produce, and it mass-produces them by several thousand times than they can. So they are filling the skies, and every moment of the soldiers' movements is monitored. The drones explode, they're heat detecting. In night moments are very difficult. So at the moment, they're not getting the Western weapons as quickly as they want. They're not getting the permission to use these long-range missiles, and they're being outpowered, basically. And so we're seeing this creep there on the Eastern Front.
It is staggering, the drone warfare. I think you have to step back, because there's one thing saying it's overwhelming, but to see it and see it in practice is different. You talk about the Russians. The Ukrainians, I heard one figure, the Economist chief reporter, talking to one of the drone operators, saying that an average monthly flight of drones was 1,300,000 drone flights in 1 month, Ukrainian, which gives you the sense, I think, of how it changed the face of the conflict.
Sure. And those drones have a life expectancy of a few weeks, maximum a month. So it's a huge amount of money that's being poured into this. And the Ukrainian troops at the front line now, before they're asking for flak jackets or ammunition, what they're asking for now is drone jammers on the back of their cars
and yet,
put in the field.
The Ukrainians surprised them in Kursk 2 months ago.
Yep. I guess the Russians maybe took their eye off the ball there. Perhaps that was a bit of the front line that wasn't guarded. A surprise move. On the east, it's not the case. On the east, Russia knows that it can use this momentum to push forward. So this operation in Kursk has been a morale boost for Ukraine and a surprise, bad surprise for Russia. Vladimir Putin said he wanted the Ukrainians out of there by October the 1st. He's not met that deadline, but I mean, it's very volatile there as well.
Gil, you've nicely teed up Kursk. Catherine was there. She didn't say it herself a short while
ago.
She's
too modest.
Let's see, Catherine, in with Ukrainians in their incursion there. This is one village that we're not allowed to name, but we explain what's going on here within the piece. It says, newly arrived Ukrainian soldier and their interactions with Russian villagers.
Oleksiy is the Ukrainian commander charged with overseeing the Russian population here. He tries to convince them of the realities of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Russia показывала освобожденный якобы населенный пункт. Там вообще ни одного двора не осталось. Бахмуте, другие города Украины, там где побывали россияне. То же самое было в Киевской области. Ирпень, Буча.
В руках Украины?
Нет, это неправда.
Неправда?
Нет, это неправда.
Ну да, да, это дальше.
Catherine, it's something they've spoken about before, the importance of the information war going on right there.
Oh, you can see it there, and that's right up quite near the Ukrainian border, in this very small rural village, and the Kremlin lines, the talking points were just coming out, cut and dried. It's so powerful. It's such a powerful propaganda machine. Mm-hmm. People in that village told us they thought this war had started on August the 6th when Ukrainian troops crossed the border into Russia. They didn't think that, I mean, they'd heard some bombing. They thought something was going on, but they kept themselves to themselves. They said they were simple people, but they didn't know. I mean, off camera and things they were asking, so is President Zelensky a Nazi? You know, they were very suspicious of the Ukrainian troops. Ukrainian troops incredibly suspicious of them, worried about them giving away their positions. So it's a very uneasy atmosphere. Mm. And you see just how strongly the Russian propaganda machine has taken hold, that people can hear bombings from Ukraine. Mm. But they don't think that the war has started because they've been told there is no war. So it was incredible, really. A parallel reality.
Vivian, parallel reality, and one in which Mark Rutte is now arriving in town as the new NATO boss. Is he what NATO needs right now?
You know, you started off the show by calling him the Trump Whisperer, one of his monikers. I just don't think that's going to cut it, actually. I mean, they're going to need like a Trump shouter rather than whisperer. Even then, I'm not sure, you know, anything's going to really work. And I think this is a problem that, depending on the outcome of the US election, this could be a very different situation in a few months' time. We've already had Trump effectively saying he's, you know, ready to get rid of this war and, you know, solve it on day one, as he put it, which effectively means, you know, forget about NATO, forget about diplomacy, whatever. We're just going to demand that, like, you know, Ukraine takes it and gives up territory and walks away. And that could effectively be what happens. We could see the US maybe pull out of NATO. He threatened it once before, didn't do it, but he might do it the second time around. And I think that, you know, Mark Rutte is going to be seeing a lot more, obviously, of Zelensky. But it's very hard to know how he can really sort things out.
He needs to be a Trump bellower, and maybe that doesn't work. Suzanne, Mark Rutte was asked on day one, is Ukraine losing the war? As we get into now the third winter of conflict, what's your sense of the state of play?
So Mark Rutte and Donald Trump have Teflon in common in their nicknames. Donald Trump is also nicknamed Teflon Don. And I was actually speaking to a former Trump official, and if Donald Trump were to return to the White House, this official would likely return as well. And they said that they really like Mark Rutte and they feel very confident in the relationship between Trump and the new NATO chief. However, they did push back on the fact that he's considered a Trump whisperer. And they said that actually they expect there to be a real alliance with teeth. And so my sense from this conversation was that there isn't necessarily an immediate danger of the US just leaving NATO, that Trump really fancies himself a deal maker. So for him, a win would be a deal. And people that I've spoken to who actually have been the ones who've had to do the negotiations of his deals, whether that was the Abraham Accords mm-hmm. or the negotiations with the North Koreans in Singapore, he's very hands-on. And so, and he directs his people almost down to, I was told by one source, down to the body language. And so wow. I think that publicly there's a lot of rhetoric around what we think is going to happen with Trump and NATO, but we might be surprised.
Okay, well, we'll see. There are many avenues to go in. Let's see if that one is a possibility. This takes us to the States, because the southeast of the US dealing with the most deadly storm since Hurricane Katrina 2 decades ago, Hurricane Helene, devastating parts of Florida, North and South Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, the death toll surpassing 200, almost a million left without power. Politics are in crisis mode too. The two presidential candidates diverting from planned campaign stops. Kamala Harris heading to Georgia and North Carolina, both badly damaged, both key battleground states. Donald Trump on similar manoeuvres, capitalising on the politics of disaster. He opined on social media that President Biden, Kamala Harris were, quote, universally being given poor grades for the way they handle the relief effort. In the middle of all of this, Tuesday night, the one and only moment to see the potential Veeps go head-to-head, 90 minutes and primetime spot for the vice presidential candidates J.D. Vance and Tim Walz. This is how the running mates debate went down.
Governor Walz, you said you were in Hong Kong during the deadly Tiananmen Square protests in the spring of 1989. But Minnesota Public Radio and other media outlets are reporting that you actually didn't travel to Asia until August of that year. Can you explain that discrepancy?
Yeah, well, and to the folks out there who didn't get at the top of this, look, I grew up in small rural Nebraska, town of 400, town that you rode your bike with your buddies till the streetlights come on, and I'm proud of that service.
Governor, just to follow up on that, the question was, can you explain the discrepancy?
Just, all I said on this was, is I got there that summer and misspoke on this, so I will just, that's what I've said.
Senator Vance, in 2016, you called your running mate Donald Trump unfit for the nation's highest office, and you said he could be America's Hitler.
I was wrong about Donald Trump. I was wrong, first of all, because I believed some of the media stories that turned out to be dishonest fabrications of his record. But most importantly, Donald Trump delivered for the American people.
Gil, who won?
Well, I think technically, Vance was better. He knows the media. He's a professional. Waltz was not at ease. You see that he lacks. You see the guy from the town with 400 inhabitants who rides bike until the lights go off. but the question is, because you know, there's a lot of criticism about Trump saying, you know, whatever, and lying and improvising. How in hell? And the fact is that it works for some people. Mm. So the notes that we can give objectively doesn't mean that this is the way things are perceived by the Americans, by the voters. And there was something, nice and warm about Waltz. I mean, your
stick.
Kind
Coach
of a bearish
yeah.
uncle. Yes, you know, sorry, I did this, I did that. And the other guy is, the perfect salesperson. So the question is, how...
Who
this,
do you want?
This,
do you want the salesperson?
This subliminal message
yeah.
will work, and not today, you know, because it's working little by little in people's minds. Changes.
Yeah.
He's a nice guy. I like him. I don't like him. This kind of judgments.
That's a very good point, Suzanne. Whether it actually does matter on a subliminal level. Anthony Scaramucci, former spokesperson for Donald Trump, who now supports Kamala Harris, who was on this program fairly recently, said that Walz looked lost. Did that matter?
So it's true. I mean, I think this election, anybody who says they know what's going to happen and who's going to win doesn't. I mean, it is completely down to the wire, mm-hmm. and a lot of people are going to end up going into that voting box and looking at the names and voting based on how they feel. Mm. And so I think that the subliminal messaging of all of these debates, they're not necessarily, it's not really necessarily about policy. It's kind of about feeling. That's true. And I think that the debates normally do not necessarily shift sentiments in the past. But this year, we've had one debate that literally led to a candidate dropping out. And then this debate was so normal that everyone was shocked. So that's the state of affairs right now. And I think that I'm really glad, actually, that you also brought up the hurricanes, because J.D. Vance, part of his rise to political fame was his book Hillbilly Elegy. He's from this part of the country that he says that is largely ignored, the white working class. And
Glenn
now,
Close was his grandmother.
Well, so this is basically the way that the media is covering or not covering, some would say not covering enough, is playing directly into J.D. Vance's hands right now.
And if we look, Vivienne, at the unfortunate nickname Tim Walz has picked up, which is Tiananmen Tim, got himself in a mess saying he was somewhere he wasn't, and it was a misspoke. But the other thing that struck me about that, I'm sure you all did, was the fact that J.D. Vance said halfway through, hang on, I thought we weren't fact-checking this debate. And we were all, hang on,
who cares about
this.
Facts, right?
I mean, you know, this is such, I would say nonsense, but not, you can't say anything in this election is nonsense. It's so neck and neck, as Suzanne says. It's like every tiny little thing matters. Every single little vote matters in the three or four states that actually matter. So every nuance could swing things one way or another. The one thing I do kind of disagree with a little bit is I kind of feel like virtually everybody in America has at this point decided who they're going to vote for. Many have already started voting. So my ballot paper is lying on my desk at home, about to be mailed off.
Post it. Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's, in a way it doesn't matter, but in another way, Kamala Harris could have used him to be a little bit more on his game, and he wasn't.
Which brings us a way to end this program. Politically, another person who perhaps wasn't on his game, we asked exactly 3 months ago, British Prime Minister, summer election victory, could Keir Starmer steer calmer? But it didn't take long for the government to become embroiled in a scandal, political honeymoon well and truly over. Stories emerging of the Prime Minister accepting gifts, donations, clothing, his glasses, director's boxes for football matches, his wife clothing too, Lady Victoria, Victoria Sponger, as satirists began to call her. So the question here, as Beth Rigby put to him, it doesn't look good, though, Minister, does it? Don't you get it? He said, I've done nothing wrong, but I'm paying back 6,000 of some of the free gifts I've taken, including Taylor Swift tickets. So here's the question. Is it OK to accept free gifts? Catherine.
Well, as a journalist, no. But politicians, so for example, he's an ardent football or soccer fan, so he wants to go and watch, and he goes every week with his family to watch it. But now he goes to watch it in a box, which is he gets as a freebie, because he has to have extra police protection. Are we saying that he can't do that anymore? I think that's a little unfair. The main thing is, look, he's paying back this £6,000. I'm sorry, the last British government had so many freebies, so many gifts from ultra-rich friends. Boris Johnson had gold wallpaper at several hundred pounds a roll in Downing Street. Look at all the COVID PPE contracts that were given out to mates. The scale of this is bad, and yet it's generating all these reams of terrible headlines for Starmer, which he's handled really very badly.
He should read again his classics. Beware of Brits bearing gifts.
Very clever. Suzanne, final word to you on this one. Does it... Keir Starmer, I guess the issue was he was hoisted by his own petard, trying to state, I'll be different, we're bringing about change, and taking clothes, glasses, and the rest, and now paying it back. What do you make of it?
So as someone who has a startup that blends fashion and foreign news and kind of uses lifestyle to get people to pay attention to the news, I would say that optics matter, and he needs to decide, does he want to be prime minister or an influencer?
Ah, very good. Well, that leaves us nicely. Thank you so much to this week's guests, Gilma Healy, Vivian Walt, Catherine Norris-Trent, Suzanne Kiampor. Thank you for watching. And talking of politics of freebies, we're going to leave you with this exchange between President Erdogan and Putin back in 2018. See you next week.
А? 210? Вот министру раздадите. Ему на развитие авиации.
Спасибо. Защита.